We take you now directly to the floor of the House of Representatives and an ongoing debate between Representative Joe Wilson, Republican of South Carolina, and Representative Alan Grayson, Democrat of Florida.
You lie!
You die!
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And let's face it, Ken, there just really isn't that much funny to say about what's going on in Washington these days because it's just gotten too grim. There's no more civility.
There's also no policies. And we don't have a health care policy. We don't have an Afghanistan policy.
Sure we do. We have the policies we had before the Obama administration and the new Congress came to power. They're still trying to work out their changes. But in the meantime, we're still in Afghanistan and we still have the health care system that we've always had.
But where's the change that we believe in?
The change that we believe in is still making its way through the system because there is a lot of resistance.
Well, the news this week was basically the two votes in the Senate Finance Committee on the public option, and both failed.
That's correct.
And Democrats crossed over. At least five Democrats in one vote, three Democrats in another one, voting against the public option, including Chairman Max Baucus.
That's right. And we've known for quite some time that Max Baucus's position here, and he didn't put a public option in his own version of the bill.
Because he won 60 votes.
And he wants to pass the Senate Finance Committee with, he hopes, at least one or two Republican votes. And he knew he wouldn't get those with a public option. He also knew that there were two or three other Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee that would never go for a public option. So he just didn't put one in his bill because he didn't want his particular flavor to fail in his own committee.
And yet they still have to merge that bill with the Senate health bill, which does have a public option, which is much more expensive. And then whatever comes out of that Senate thing has to be merged with whatever comes out of the House.
Which will have a public option and be more expensive.
Much more expensive, right.
So there is a great deal of territory yet to be covered. But there is a vehicle moving now after all these many months. I would say that the House will pass its bill sometime in November. The Senate will pass its bill sometime in probably late October, early November, and that the conference committee will begin by the time we get to Thanksgiving. And I think that the House will actually act fairly quickly after the Senate Finance Committee has finished and after the Senate floor debate has begun. But the House is waiting to make sure the Senate is, in fact, going to come forth with a bill so that they don't get left out to dry as they have been in the past.
Jay Rockefeller and Chuck Schumer, two Democrats on Senate Finance who obviously support the public option, say, look, this is not the last we've heard of it. Obviously, there will be more votes, and we probably will do far better on the Senate floor than we will in the Senate Finance Committee.
And any time that Congress is about to undertake something that is quite large and transformative of so much of the entire national economy, something like a fifth of the national economy is associated with health care, incrementalism sets in. It's a big, ugly word, but what it basically means is the nose of the camel gets under the tent, and the people who want to see the system change settle for a little now and the opportunity to come back for more later. If there's no bill at all, they don't get that.
I think there's less willingness in Washington for an incremental policy on Afghanistan.
Well, that's much tougher because there you have stark choices. You have the general saying if we don't get more troops, and by more troops we mean a lot more, like maybe half again as many as are there now, we're just simply going to fail. The mission is not going to work, and we're going to essentially have the Taliban throwing us out of Afghanistan rather than vice versa. The other choice is you send in troops, the quagmire gets deeper, we stay and we stay. The Karzai government isn't popular with its own people who apparently tried to vote it out. And where are we then? We're looking at another Vietnam, or so the opponents say.
If anything, it seems like the Obama administration, if they're going to find allies in their fight for more troops, if indeed they want more troops, it'll be the Republican Party where they'll have to go for answers because the fellow Democrats seem to be very split.
Yes, it's a complete inversion from health care because the power structure among the Democrats, starting really with Joe Biden right there in the White House, are saying, let's take our big political hit now on Afghanistan and say we're going to withdraw. We can't win this thing without such a commitment that would be far beyond public support in this country.
There are indications that Secretary of State Clinton is among those people in the administration pushing for more troops.
She's a kind of modified hawk, it seems. She is tasked with, as the State Department head, the nation building that has to go on if this is going to be a successful policy, if you're going to try to keep the Taliban from coming back and running Afghanistan and bringing al-Qaeda with them. She doesn't want those people out there trying to build up these villages and hold out the Taliban. Taliban without adequate security, which would have to come from boots on the ground. So she seems to be making common cause with the generals.
Obviously, either decision will play into the 2010 elections.
Now, the Republicans are winners either way.
They might be.
Because if there's a quagmire, it's all Obama's after whatever decision he makes this fall makes it his war.
It's his war.
No matter how we got there. On the other hand, if he makes the dramatic move of scaling back our commitment there and essentially letting the Taliban come back, that's going to reverse the polling on this war, which has been essentially very lukewarm. All of a sudden, people are going to be jumping to the idea that this president has failed to defend America. Not everybody, of course, and his core supporters will still say, yeah, that was the smart call. He's a courageous guy. But that swing vote, that big 20-30% of the total vote that goes back and forth, a lot of those people are not going to like the spectacle of us bailing out of the mission we started right after 9/11.
Okay, so we're talking about, obviously, increasing troops in Afghanistan. We're also talking about increasing troops in Iowa, like this week.
Yeah, so the troops are beginning to turn out.
Rick Santorum is the latest former senator from Pennsylvania.
Now, here's a question for you, Ken, because I know that you are a trivia master.
I follow politics.
Who was the last person to lose his Senate reelection campaign by 20 percentage points and go on to be elected president?
Nobody?
I can't think of anybody right off.
But who was the last person who, right after his last defeat, was elected president?
Abraham Lincoln.
No, somebody more recent than that.
All right, I suppose you're thinking of Richard Nixon, 1962 California gubernatorial loser. You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore, and 6 years later he's back and he's getting elected president. Do you think that's in Rick Santorum's mind?
I'd like to know what's in Rick Santorum's mind, because what's he thinking of?
Here's my guess as to what Rick Santorum is thinking. Like a lot of other Republicans, he deeply believes the 2008 election was an anomaly, that it does not reflect any change in the basic trends in American politics.
And the Republican Party lost its way. They were not true to Republican philosophy. Rick Santorum is true to Republican philosophy.
That's right. They let the government get too big. And Rick Santorum can say he was against all that. Here's the real point, though. He believes that whomever the Republicans nominate in 2012 will be elected president, because the country won't be focusing on that person so much as they're focusing on Barack Obama. It will be the equivalent of the rejection, say, of Jimmy Carter or the rejection of George H.W. Bush after one term.
Or of this podcast.
And if you posit that whomever the Republicans nominate is going to be the next president, all you have to do is be popular among Republicans. It isn't as challenging as being elected senator of Pennsylvania, where you have to appeal to Democrats and independents. And he clearly believes the Republican Party will be reaching for the most conservative, ideological, economic, and social conservative they can find in 2012.
I thought the way to get the nomination is to write a book.
Well,
and have it come out on November 17th.
Well, but I think you have to write a book that's got a catchy title.
Like Conflict and Compromise.
I say like Topical Application of Pitt and Fisher Sealants.
Or I saw them in concert,
or,
by the way.
Going Rogue.
Going Rogue.
Ken, have you read the manuscript yet for Sarah Palin's book?
I have not. No, the book comes out on November 17th. They moved it up because it'll be a big Christmas sale. They're ordering 1.5 million copies. And look, again, we have the same debate in the Republican Party that we've had ever since she was picked as running mate.
Her numbers are still very good among Republicans.
But there are a lot of Republicans who say that absolutely she should not be the party's choice in 2012. Her collaborator, Lynn Vincent, a very conservative evangelical, writes for The World magazine. Mm-hmm. Her latest book is a book called Donkey Kong, Sex, Crime, and Corruption in the Democratic Party. You basically know what you're going to get in a collaborative effort between Sarah Palin and Lynn Vincent.
And here's my question. Would it not have been possible for Sarah Palin to look for a larger name person, somebody
like Nick Galifianakis or George Duke Magian?
Somebody,
or Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Somebody in the mainstream of the Republican Party, somebody who would have something, a reputation as a journalist or as an author or even as a ghostwriter, just to sort of show people that she was trying to raise the level of her appeal a little bit?
What's wrong with you, Ron Elving, is that you're thinking like the mainstream media. That's exactly what the mainstream media would want to talk about. They want a logical, famous person, not somebody who's from the movement who's a true believer.
All right, so we've got Santorum, we've got Palin, both spending a certain amount of time in pursuit of this particular Republican energy right now, want to be the hero or heroine of that particular energy as we go into 2010. There's going to be a lot of campaigning to do for other people. And they want to kind of put somebody like, say, Mitt Romney, or for that matter, Huckabee or Tim Pawlenty into this sort of 2008 past and associate them with that so that they become the cutting edge of the party, the leading edge of the party going into 2012.
And I think going into 2010, perhaps what might be helping the Republican Party is Democrat disunity. And we saw that in recent days in Colorado when Michael Bennett, the appointed senator, because Ken Salazar was named Interior Secretary, Michael Bennett now has a serious challenge from Andrew Romanoff.
Yes, and of course, this is a person who's been in the state legislature for a period of time.
Speaker of the House, 2 terms.
And a leader there, and is now term limited. He's looking for something else to do, so he's going to run for the United States Senate and challenge this appointee who's never been elected, who was appointed, of course, not by the Obama administration, but by the governor of Colorado. And yet, the Obama administration has endorsed Michael Bennett already and put itself out there as supporting him, which may or may not be sort of a divisive thing for Democrats in Colorado.
Usually the administration supports incumbents, as they did with Kirsten Gillibrand in New York, but not David Patterson.
Not in the case of David Patterson, no. And that's a real case of Democratic disunity. I mean, we don't know yet how divisive among Democrats in Colorado that particular challenge will be, but it's very clear that the Democrats in New York have a problem.
The problem, actually, was not so much Barack Obama's intervention in New York, but the problem was David Patterson. His numbers have been tanking from day one. His numbers are now the lowest of his governorship. Matter of fact, his numbers apparently are lower than Eliot Spitzer's. And so President Obama, looking at 2010, looking at some vulnerable House seats, like the freshman who won the Gillibrand seat upstate New York, looking at the state Senate, which the Democrats barely won in 2008. So they know that the Democrats are in trouble and they want somebody strong at the top of the ticket. They feel that is not David Patterson.
Would he have stepped out of his own volition, not wanting to be beaten by Rudy Giuliani or whomever the Republicans might put up? Might he have stepped out on his own if it were not for the White House's interference, as some people have implied?
Well, the fact is there's still major budget wrangling that has to go on in New York, and David Patterson, to be a lame duck, would have hurt his bargaining power. So I think if he was going to drop out, it certainly wouldn't have been after the budget problem. But it's clear that Andrew Cuomo, the state attorney general, is waiting in the wings. Cuomo now is very quiet.
He doesn't want to be challenging
David
Patterson.
He's doing everything right.
He's waiting and hoping that Patterson can be persuaded not to run.
And I'm convinced Patterson does not run.
The budget has been resolved, he'll step back.
The polls will show it. I think Democrats will demand it, even though last week on Meet the Press, David Patterson said, look, you know, I may be blind, but I'm not oblivious. I know what's out there, but I am definitely running for governor, and I'm convinced he is not running for governor.
All right, well, stay tuned. What about the situation in the gubernatorial contests that are coming up next month? It's typical that a year after a presidential election, the party that won the presidential election gets bad news from New Jersey and Virginia.
Well, especially Virginia. That's been the case since 1977. Jimmy Carter won in 76. Republican John Dalton won in 1977. For the last 30 years, that's been the case in Virginia.
And it's been often the case in New Jersey,
right,
as well.
Right, exactly. Now, but here's the thing with Virginia, though. Even after a month and a half of the so-called Bob McDonnell thesis, where he basically his views were from the 19th century about women's rights and working women, things like that, he still has a lead over Cree Deeds. Doug Wilder, the former governor of Virginia, has refused to endorse either candidate.
And he is, of course, a former Democratic governor and was the first African-American governor of Virginia 20 years ago.
First African-American governor since Reconstruction anywhere in any state in the country when he was elected in 1989. But Doug Wilder is often Doug Wilder. He likes to be wooed. He likes people to come begging for his endorsement. Sometimes he gives it, sometimes he doesn't. It's a game he plays every 4 years.
Do you think there's some chance he still comes around and endorses Deeds before November?
There's a lot of pressure on him, and we still have plenty of time for that. But my point is that after a month and a half of the McDonnell thesis being out there, the fact that McDonnell still has a lead makes me think that Deeds is going to have to come up with something more to say other than remember that thesis. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I still suspect that even though the headlines have not been good to the Republicans and McDonnell,
and the gap has closed a little bit, that probably has more to do with McDonnell coming to earth than Cree Deeds really tapping into any kind of voter enthusiasm. And something very similar is going on in New Jersey, is it not, where Chris Christie's numbers have come down as he's been pounded with a lot of negative ads. But that hasn't really made John Corzine any more popular, and his numbers haven't come up much, if measurably at all.
And it's not so much that Christie has been pounded by negative ads, although that is the case, but Christie has done some self-destructive things as well as regarding taxes, regarding loans to friends, regarding conversations he may or may not have had with Karl Rove about his political career. So first of all, New Jersey is a far more of a blue state than Virginia, so I would suspect that that numbers would come down too. You can't count out John Corzine, but the guy is not lovable. He's not especially liked, and the economic situation in New Jersey is pretty precarious.
And has been for the entire recession.
And with the economic uncertainty of the country, some Republicans feel that if you go to California, for example, some Republicans feel that pro-business candidates are the way to go. And what better pro-business candidates do you have in California than two women who are running, Meg Whitman for governor and Carly Fiorina for the Senate? They both are political novices. They've never run for office before. But some people feel that they have the business background, the acumen, to represent a new kind of Republican Party.
In a sense, it's the old Republican Party, though, isn't it? The party of business, the party that was
less ideological
than the Democrats, that knew how to run things, that knew how to manage an economy. And this was the Republican Party as we thought of it primarily before the ideological splits of the 70s and 80s, based largely on social issues, before the Vietnam War. This was the primary identity of the Republican Party. And they think they see that now in Meg Whitman, former chief executive of eBay, who many Republicans think could breathe new life into the party out in California. But she's not running first or even second in the polls among Republicans right now. She's running third, and it's partly because it was exposed that she didn't ever register to vote until 2002. This is a woman in her 50s, and that she hasn't even voted every time since 2002. So it seems a little bit of an opportunistic move for her now to suddenly decide she wants to get into politics and start at the top as governor of California.
Well, it's also an opportunistic move by people who support her, thinking that they could just airlift a candidate with no political experience and with so much uncertainty into the governorship.
But you know what she has?
She has a lot of money.
She has what John Corzine has, which is an extraordinary personal fortune. She's already put millions of dollars of her own money into the campaign, and people have talked about her spending $100 million or more on her own behalf. Now, that's Corzine kind of money, and we haven't seen that, even in California, up to now.
One thing we're not talking about when we're talking about Whitman or Fiorina is ideology, and that could be the problem because conservatives are distrustful of both candidates. They feel that it's one thing to be appealed to this pro-business whatever, but core social issues are being ignored. So you have Chuck DeVore, who's a conservative assemblyman, is running against Fiorina in the Senate primary. You have State Insurance Commissioner Steve Poizner, who is a conservative, will be challenging Whitman for governor. And the conservatives usually run things in the Republican Party primary.
That's right. I would take Steve Poizner very seriously in the gubernatorial contest, but he's going to be badly outspent. And he himself is from the high-tech world of Northern California, the Silicon Valley world. He is not a Southern California social conservative. There isn't one really running among the first tier of candidates. That's kind of surprising. The third candidate, who's also out there doing fairly well, is former Congressman Tom Campbell, who's been working for Arnold Schwarzenegger as his budget director. My goodness.
Yeah, but he's a liberal. He's pretty much of a liberal.
By Republican Party standards, in California or most any other state, hard to imagine that he would be the solution. But then look at Arnold Schwarzenegger, the only Republican to be elected to a top statewide office in what? More than a decade in California.
But the point is, Republicans do not want to look at Arnold Schwarzenegger because, one, his numbers are down. Two, he has embraced many Obama administration economic positions. And three, conservatives can't stand him. So if the Republicans are going to recapture, it's funny, you have a Republican governor of California, but conservatives still feel they want to recapture the governorship. And if they do that, it has to be somebody, a non-Schwarzenegger.
It's true. And it's interesting. He came, the great hero who had saved the Republican Party in California, came to his own state convention last weekend, gave the opening speech on the first night, and left immediately. And so will we, because that's the end of this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. I wish they